mostly about the listening you're doing this week, the composers like Varese and Parch and Nan Caro and Rudyard. You may want to take out your cassette guide. There's one change that they made, I guess because of timing. It's on cassette page 3. It says number 4, Morton Feldman, after Harry Parch. I guess because it was too long, they actually changed the order, and they put the Feldman actually after number 7, after Henry Cowell. So it's on the other side. They announce what everything is, so it shouldn't confuse you, but just for the sake of whatever. As I mentioned earlier in the course, we've divided this into 4 parts, and today is the last of the talks on the second part, which is called The Purpose of New Music, or The Purpose of Music, which we've approached from quite a few different angles. After that, we will switch into slightly more technical discussions of how the techniques that are used in new music are a manifestation of the composer's idea of what the purpose of the piece should be. And we'll be going to that starting next week. As many of you pointed out in the very first, second week of school, when you all wrote down what you thought the purpose of the new music is, you can't really say that the purpose of music is the same for the composer as it is for the listener. And basically what I've been discussing this whole time, the last, what, 3 or 4 weeks, is from the compositional point of view, from the composer, what the purpose of a piece is, why a composer would write. To me personally, I think the best remark was the Feldman one I left you with at the end of last class, that the purpose of music is a total commitment to our own uniqueness. Now, Feldman was saying this. Can I erase this now? Has everyone seen it enough and know how to spell inauguration and everything now? Feldman was talking about a specific composer when he said this. He was talking about a French immigrant composer to this country by the name of Edgar Varese. Varese was born in 1883, died in the 60s, about 1965. And he came to this country in 1915, originally just as a visit, but decided to stay, eventually married an American woman and stayed in this country. I think you can say with some fairness, and not with a kind of prejudice either, that there were 2 kinds of immigrants coming to this country. There were those kinds of immigrants coming to this country where the situation in their own country was completely intolerable, where they couldn't survive in some way or another, obviously like a Jew in Nazi Germany. The 2 most famous, who I've mentioned quite a lot, is Arnold Schoenberg, who came from Germany, and Igor Stravinsky, who came from Russia and France. I can't spell today. Stravinsky. Sometimes with a Y. These 2 composers, in a way, didn't come to America to embrace American culture. They came to America because they couldn't really survive in Europe. And they came to America, in essence, to bring their wares with them, almost like merchants selling their wares. They didn't come to really absorb American culture or be part of it so much as to survive. And I think you can see this in a comment of Schoenberg that he made when he was talking about why he wrote music the way he did. He said, "I can't do it any other way. It doesn't work any other way. Only I did not choose to write like that. I do not go out of my way to write like that, and it would be a relief to feel I might do it differently." Interesting to feel so trapped in one's own style. Varese, I think, represents the other kind of immigrant that comes to this country. He comes to this country to find his own uniqueness, because in the cultural imperatives of Europe were such that he could not really explore the things he wanted to do with the kind of open-mindedness that he could do here. And I think what happened by the 1900s, essentially, in this country, is we really did have a culture. We had a very strange kind of culture, but we had a very strong culture. And the difference of our culture in America in that time was it was receptive rather than restrictive. If you think about Schoenberg, his culture was extremely restrictive. Germanic culture about how music should be, how it should exist, how it should follow tradition, was very, very rigid, whereas ours was very, very open. I have a little dictionary that I bought years ago from 1870, printed in Massachusetts, and I looked up culture the other day just to see what they said, and the definition is that which is cultivated. I thought that was sort of nice, 1879 definition of culture. So I started thinking about American culture like a garden. And what makes American culture interesting and receptive, it's sort of like a wonderful arboretum where you bring trees from all over the world and plant them together in a garden, and they all coexist very nicely, but they're not the indigenous species there. After a while, they become the indigenous species because they fertilize the soil and they continue to grow. So American soil at that stage was extremely receptive to new kinds of plants, and people like Verrez and some other people we're going to talk about in a second, when they come to this country, find an openness here that they couldn't find in Europe. Verrez, like Ives, wrote peculiar music and consequently was very unsuccessful in his lifetime. His music was very rarely played. Like Ives, he had a tremendous influence on other composers and the artistic community at that stage, especially in New York, but in terms of public success, there was very little. But again, we go back to what I was saying last week. What is success? If success is measured by popularity, is popularity worth changing your own personality for? Or, in the words of Morty Feldman that I ended last class with when he said, before he died, I have no regrets. Do you want to say, I have no regrets, or they loved me? Verrez wanted to say, I have no regrets. The interesting thing about immigrants like Verrez, though, is that they had they brought a lot of European influence to this country, too, because Verrez, having grown up in France, actually trained in mathematics and engineering originally, comes to this country bringing, maybe not embracing, but bringing a lot of the notions of what was going on in the avant-garde movements, especially in France at that time. And I think probably the most liberal culture in Europe, in terms of really challenging the premises of what culture was about, was France. Probably, I don't know, I don't want to speculate too much, but possibly because, like the United States, they had a strong revolution at one stage, and a strong revolution explicitly questions authority, and it becomes a kind of model of culture after that of questioning authority. Now, a large discontent was growing in France way before the turn of the century, but since this is only about this century, we won't go back too far. One of the startling plays that was written in 1896 was by Alfred Jarret, or Jarry, I don't know how, my French is terrible, called Ubu Wa, Ubu the King. Jarret was very young when he wrote this, he was only 22. And I was thinking, actually, as I go more and more over the kind of revolutionary movements that have been happening in this century, generally, they're led by quite young people. Generally, the people that are starting new movements are in their early 20s. And I think probably because that's the age when you really become aware that what you are is not necessarily what you've been taught, but that is something else. And probably the most extreme questioning that you do in life is at that stage. And I think, consequently, a lot of the cultural changes that have happened have been led by people of that age. Well, this play was a big scandal. Because it defied all sensibility. The main character, Ubu the King, was dressed with a horse's head on him and shaped like a pear and looked very, very strange. And he spoke an extremely stylized language that always used the royal we, since he was the king, and most of the play didn't make much sense. The play opened, first of all, with Jarret coming out and bringing a table with him with an absolutely filthy tablecloth on it and telling the people that basically there was nothing to understand in the play in his own way. And then the play opens with, and the first word of the play was extremely taboo in those days. In French it's merde, in English it's shit. And it caused the audience to start screaming. Some supported it, some didn't. By the end of the play, people were beating each other up, etc., etc. Well, he became a real cult idol in an interesting way. And started dressing like Ubu on the streets. He slicked his hair back. He would wear an old trench coat with holes in it, bedroom slippers, and like a fur tiara around his neck most of the time. And he had a whole cult following. A whole bunch of people started dressing strangely and speaking in this strange mannered French. There's an interesting quote of him, I think, sort of explains things. Talking about things that are understandable only weighs down the mind and falsifies the memory. But the absurd exercises the mind and makes the memory work. Well, in a sense, he made himself into an art piece as a kind of way of expressing his own absolute contempt, really, for the kind of absurdity of culture. He made his own life into an absurdity, and he died at a very young age. He led a kind of almost a movie-esque kind of French artist life, living in a tiny little room that was no bigger than a closet. He lived with his two owls. When the owls died, he had them stuffed and put back in the room. He was found right before he died. He hadn't left the room for many days, and the room was filthy, and some of his friends came in, and he was half paralyzed and starving. And his last words before he died was, "Can I please have a toothpick?" Well, this kind of absurdity that was going on, in a sense, generated another movement that was really to become a movement. At this stage, it was kind of a cult. But then, after that, a new movement started, which was called Futurism. And it was started by Filippo Marinetti. In 1909, in a manifesto which he published in Paris. The manifesto published in Paris was basically a declaration of a new world order, as he felt. Marinetti was at the premiere of this play and knew this movement very well, and although he was Italian and went back to Italy after the play, there was a strong connection with France in between, and he would go back and forth from France, and a lot of the futurist activities took place in France or in especially Russia, too, at that stage. Marinetti. Futurists must teach all authors and performers to despise the audience. Applause only means it is mediocre, dull, regurgitated, or too well disguised. Thanks to us, the time will come when life will no longer be a simple matter of bread and labor, nor life of idleness either, but life will be a work of art. Well, in this new movement, there were a lot of things happened, but they started a new kind of theater that was very much like futurism, like Ubu. And these plays tended to really offend the audience. In fact, they went out of their way to offend the audience. They would do things like sell all the seats twice. They had this other thing that they liked to do, which was put glue on the seats. So you would come in. And essentially, they declared war on the audience to sort of make the audience aware again of this kind of cultural revolution. In the manifesto, he said, "Go out into the street, launch assaults from theaters, introduce the fisticuffs into artistic battle." And they were extreme troublemakers. They were arrested all the time, they're in the newspapers all the time, they caused an incredible sensation, and that was their idea of creating this incredible sensation. It ended sort of sadly because politically they were quite closely related to the fascist movement in Italy, and Mussolini was part of that. And the movement really ended when Mussolini took power. Marinetti resigned from this, disavowed all allegiance with this at the time. So this kind of theatrics of absurdity and simultaneity that was going on with the futurists was very, very much a part of the European scene already by about 1910. In terms of music, the futurists, there was a manifesto written by Luigi Russolo. By the way, most of these people were not musicians. He was a poet, he was a painter, but they all sort of merged in the art, sort of like what's going to happen in the 60s, which we'll get to in a couple of weeks. Russolo wrote a manifesto, like they all like to do, called The Art of Noise, where he said that essentially the 20th century was now a new kind of society and noise had been introduced into it and noise was very much part of it. Quote, "In the 19th century, with the invention of the machine, noise was born. Today, noise triumphs, reigns supreme over the sensibilities of men." So what they did is they built a whole new series of instruments, unfortunately all destroyed in World War II. There were these large boxes with speakers on them that made noises of different sorts. And being a manifesto and having to have something to write about, Russolo cataloged all the noises in six categories so that they could make six kinds of noise machines. I'll read you a few of his categories, not all of them. Category one includes rumbles, roars, explosions, crashes, splashes, and booms. Category number two is whistles, hisses, and snorts. Category number three, whispers, murmurs, mumbles, grumbles, jumbles, gurgles. Skipping to the last category, six. This is a rather sad one in the story. Voices of animals and men. Shouts, screams, groans, shrieks, howls, laughs, wheezes, and sobs. And they would dress up very nicely and go on stages and all play these noise machines. The sickest of the noise machines, which I almost shouldn't even say, but I'll tell you anyway, they had one machine where they had a cat in it and a speaker in front of the cat, and the tail would come out the back, and they would pull on the tail, and the cat would scream. That was one of theirs. Generally, they were received, you know, again with the same kind of scandal that I've talked about the whole time, creating a real sort of chaos and ruckus. But what was interesting about it, and the implication that's going to come back to Verres, is that for the first time, people were now really thinking not about music anymore necessarily as a collection of pitches and rhythms, but just as a collection of sounds, like sculpting sound out of pure noise rather than thinking about composing in the traditional way. And they would do concerts which were made only up of these kinds of various noises. And they traveled to Paris, and they traveled all through Italy, and Europe knew them very well. This movement was to become very relevant again, especially in the 50s and 60s. John Cage was extremely aware of the futurists, all of their writings and what they were talking about, and I'm sure used some of their ideas very directly in his own work, unquestionably. Well, another Frenchman at the time who was having a big sensation in Paris when Verres was young was a guy by the name of Marcel Duchamp. Duchamp also emigrated ultimately to the United States, but he was born, let's see, I can't remember all these dates, 1887, died 1968. By the mid-20s, he was living in New York, oh, at least half-time to full-time, and by 1950, he became a United States citizen. Well, Duchamp is really the precursor of what we talked about before, which is called Dada. And he was sort of the initiator of that movement. And in some ways, it was because he never really quite fit in with the cultural trends that were happening in Europe at that stage. Duchamp, at the height of his career in about 1920, when he was becoming extremely popular, retired. He said he retired because, quote, success is not a goal to fill an entire lifetime. The painting you probably heard about a lot is a painting called Nude Descending the Staircase, painted in 1912, which started questioning a lot of the values of the art scene. But by 1913, he was really questioning the art scene. He did a painting with oils of a chocolate grinder that he saw in a store window. And very much like what Warhol was to do about 50 years later, it was an exact duplication of the coffee grinder, exactly to every detail. Instead of painting it by normal painting standards, he used rulers to get his hands out of it, he said. So for the first time now, hanging in an art gallery is a picture of something you see in a department store. He rejected this because he said, quote, later, not quite quote, that it had perspective, and perspective is an illusion. Remember that comes back to us with Feldman? This whole idea of perspective being an illusion was part of the art scene way, way back then. So then Marcel decided to test the sensibility one degree further. And in 1913, at an art exhibition, he brought in his new thing, which he called a ready-made, which was a bicycle wheel, a real one, taken off of a bicycle, mounted on a stool, signed by Marcel Duchamp. So now, for the first time in an art gallery, you went into an art gallery and you saw something you see on the streets. In 1917, he went further, and he brought a urinal into the art gallery and signed it Marcel Duchamp and made that a piece of art. So the whole sensibility of meaning was being highly questioned by Duchamp. His last major piece he worked on for a long time, it's a large piece of glass, and it's 9 feet high and 6 feet wide, and it has these kinds of inscriptions and details on it. And a lot of it was designed by quasi-chance methods, where he would take like a piece of string and drop it on the glass, and the way it landed would become the line that he would engrave on the glass. Also, the glass was an interesting thing because he knew it would keep cracking, which it did, and it's in the Philadelphia Art Museum, but that becomes part of the whole essence of it, is that it's no longer permanent. It can't stay the same. Duchamp ended up becoming a very, very good friend of John Cage, They played a lot of chess together. We will show you, probably in the sections if we have time, a documentary on Cage where he's playing chess in this way with the video camera determined by chance where it would focus every second. So sometimes you see his hand, sometimes you see the board, sometimes you see the ceiling. And Cage still has Duchamp's chessboard in his house, and that's the one he uses all the time. Well, these ideas that were coming from Europe were very much part of the immigrants that were coming to this country. And as I say, with people like Verres and with people like Duchamp, they came to America because it was a receptive culture where they could explore their ideas to the fullest without having any cultural imperatives or cultural negations to these ideas. Verres's comment, which you'll read quite a bit of, is that music should be sound. And in a sense, he was very much influenced by this futurist, not so much philosophically, but by this notion that you could, instead of writing a piece in the traditional way, write it like a sculptor with sound masses. And the sound masses, he said, could, where is that page? Sound masses could be composed as collisions, penetrations, repulsions, transmutations, etc. So the piece you're going to listen to is one called Ionization, which is one of the very first pieces written for only percussion. It's written in 1931, is something like 13 players. And it includes sirens, like you hear for air raids, and all kinds of noises in it the whole way through. I'm going to play just a couple of minutes of the last piece he wrote called Deserts, which I think will show you that on some levels, he's still a very traditional composer. You still hear notes, you still hear movement, you still hear kind of a kinetic energy. But on another level, what's starting to happen in this music is that he's not thinking so much of that now as he's thinking of the sound. And this is what's going to influence Feldman so much with Verres. And when Feldman gets his chair at Buffalo in about 1970, it was a brand new chair and they let him name it. And he named it the Edgar Verres chair because of this kind of dedication to this guy who helped liberate the very sound of music. So this is a little bit of Deserts. Influential in the development of electronic music. From a very early age, he had this notion that wouldn't it be great if we could create sounds electronically, and again, like a sculptor, mold them in our own home. And he wrote some of the very earliest electronic music. And this piece actually alternates between this small orchestra playing and then electronic music, and then orchestra playing and then electronic music. Well, another immigrant to this country said about Verres, his name was Dane Rudyard, and we've talked about him a little bit. He said about Verres, it proclaimed a need for a music freed from intellectual abstractions, the formalism, and the narrow clannish professionalism of the European tradition. Ruggiero was born 1895, died in 1985, lived quite a long life, and probably of all the composers we're talking about this term, probably the most obscure. I doubt if anyone else on the music faculty here has even heard of him. But that doesn't matter particularly. Ruggiero, as I say, was born in France. It was not his name. When he was about 15 years old, he almost died of a kidney failure. When he was in the hospital, he said he decided that if he should survive, that he had a mission in life, and his mission in life was to help change the way people think and to help us evolve into a new culture. So he decided the most extreme thing he could do is leave his country, leave his language, go to the United States, again, a place that was extremely receptive to these ideas, and take a new name. Ruggiero is from the Sanskrit, meaning the seed bearer, the planter of seeds. Ruggiero came the year after Varèse. He was a friend of Varèse both in France and in the United States, and came to New York originally, and then in 1920 moved to Los Angeles, being even more obscure. Ruggiero was a very, very interesting character. He was, if anything, most well known for making astrology a well-known philosophy. He wrote over 40 books on the philosophy of astrology. And if astrology ever became respectable in a certain kind of way, it's primarily because of Ruggiero. Well, Ruggiero was a sort of misfit as a composer because his music really didn't fit in anywhere. It was a little too much like something and not enough like this. It's very hard for him to get performances or to get grants. Consequently, he couldn't really make a living as a composer and didn't compose all that much, although he did compose some, probably 50 or 60 pieces in his lifetime. As I say, he moved to Southern California, primarily in the desert near Palm Springs, and spent most of those years writing books on astrology as well as painting and writing poetry. Then later he moved up near San Francisco to Palo Alto. Well, Ruggiero felt, as you might expect, in a way a kind of kinship to the Greek idea of music of the spheres, that music was really magic, that certain proportions express magical ideas, that what was lost with the intellectual idea of music over the years was this kind of transcendental quality which music could have to elevate you to a higher spiritual awareness. And his music was about that kind of thing. And he wrote wrote several books on music, but one especially where he talks about the ideas, and he talks about how each interval has a special power and how you can relate these powers to different structures. His philosophy comes from an ancient Jewish mystical set of writings called the Kabbalah, and the Kabbalah pretty much is the foundation of astrology and numerology and the tarot, etc. It supposedly dates back to the ideas of Hermes Trismegistos, who was supposedly Egyptian and a theoretically new Abraham, and Abraham was introduced to these ideas theoretically, and that's how the ideas came into Jewish philosophy. Well, basically what Ruggiero did was take these notions and try to find a music that somehow could try to re-express this magic which he felt was lost. I'm going to play just a little bit of a piece for you because I need to move on. The year before he died, I was conducting a piece of his with the San Francisco Symphony. And on my way to the first rehearsal, I stopped by his house to talk to him about the piece. And he played a long piano improvisation for me. The piano's totally out of tune. He was 89 years old. And they had this terrible tape recorder there, so we recorded it. So the recording is not very good at all, but I thought it would give you an interesting notion of this 89-year-old sort of mystic sitting at home and the kind of notes that would come out at the piano. Now, for about the first 10 seconds, the tape recorder has a very hard time getting started. So it'll sound really bad for about 10 seconds, but then you can hear it a little bit better after that. on this week or whenever you get to it, so I won't play more at this stage. Turning channels from the immigrants now will go to another person who had the same feeling as Rudyard, that there was a kind of magic in music that had been lost over the years. His name was Harry Partch. Harry Partch, we're sort of talking about the renegades of music today. Harry Partch was born, I think, in 1901, let me tell you for sure. 1901, died in 1974. Partch says, "Rules and standards become meaningless once the simple truth is faced. Let us give to nuts and bolts the standardization of thread that we have come to expect. But let us give to music magic, to man magic. I discern another path, that of man, the bright adventurer, the magic maker." Well, I said many times that each American has a unique cultural history, and certainly Partch did. He grew up primarily in Benson, Arizona. I don't know if any of you have ever been to Benson. It's southern Arizona. When he grew up there, it was a town of 300. But it was a rather unusual town because it was a place where a lot of railroad workers would stop over. So the town of 300 had something like 12 saloons and a big red light district. And so even though it was a small town on certain levels, it was quite different. His parents, right before he were born, were missionaries to China for 20 years. So he remembers the library in his house being about 9/10 books in Chinese. His mother used to sing Chinese lullabies to him, and he could sing Chinese tunes. He played them and sang them. And the parents would often have guests at their house and speak Chinese, sometimes if they would stay for several days. Partch was totally self-educated. By the time he started writing music, when he was 14, what he was doing at that stage is he was doing many different kinds of things. He was playing piano for movie theaters, you know, because for silent films and things of that sort. He was a bellboy at one of the hotels, and he worked for a pharmacy, and he delivered drugs all over Benson and Albuquerque when they later moved there, especially to the red light district, he said, all the time. So Partch had this kind of real grittiness to him. We have a wonderful half-hour videotape made of him with interviews and performances that we'll show you in the sections, I think, the week after next. So Partch started writing music and reading a lot, mostly self-educated, as I said, and at a certain stage he destroyed all of his music that he had written because he felt he had taken the wrong track. Varese, by the way, did the same thing. He destroyed all the music he wrote before coming to the United States. Some of it was destroyed in a fire and some not. So, as Partch said, sometime between 1923 and 1928, and again, this date would place him about 22 years old, 23 years old, sometime between 1923 and 1928, I finally became so dissatisfied with the body of knowledge and usages as ordinarily imparted in the teaching of music that I refused to accept or develop my own work on the basis of any part of it. With respect to current usage, this refusal was a rebellion. From the standpoint of my creative work, it was the beginning of a new philosophy of music, intuitively arrived at. Just how old this new philosophy actually is has since been a continual revelation to me. It involved no small inner struggle to emerge from that spell, to discover that present progress clothed the skeleton of bondage to a specific and limited past, and to emerge from mental turmoil to the realization that what was called progress was not necessarily progress to me, however sincerely it might be accepted as such by many, perhaps even by the great majority. He went back and started reading a lot of Greek writings, and he felt that, in a sense, Greek music was the sort of source that he wanted to return to. And he divided music, you'll be reading about this in one of his writings in the source book, he divided music into two categories. One he called the corporeal, and the other the abstract. He felt the corporeal, I'll read you his definition. Corporeal was music that is vital to a time and a place, a here and a now. The word abstract, on the other hand, may be used to denote a mass expression in its highest application. The spirits of all united into one and transport it into the realm of unreality, neither here nor now, but transcending both. So Partch, first of all, became a hobo and traveled around the country on trains and lived in various places and started designing simple instruments. And he was the one I mentioned before who started questioning the whole idea of tuning and started making a whole new way of tuning instruments that sounded quite different, that were based on the natural harmonic overtone series rather than tempered tuning. Later he settled down, first in Illinois and then primarily in California for the rest of his life, and built a set of instruments and started a new kind of theater, very much based on Greek tragedy, where people sang, danced, played the instruments. He wrote the scripts, he wrote the music, he trained the musicians, he did everything. He lived in relative obscurity. He was mostly supported by, fortunately, this rich woman who thought that he was really an important figure, and he was able to continue his work because of her. She's also the one who made the film about him. You'll see the producer, Betty Freeman. She's also responsible for helping Cage and a lot of other people over the years. So anyway, Partch felt that this magic was taken out of music by the Romans, when the Catholic Church came and started making kinds of doctrines and making things abstract. He was very against what the Catholic Church had done to what he felt Greek music, which about was a kind of an immediate dramatic expression. As he said, "My Trinity is sound magic, visual beauty, and experience ritual." He denounced formal education of music, put it down. He felt the formal education of music was confining people into historical modes which were no longer relevant. He was an active spokesman against education most of his life. I don't think I'll read that to you, but you can take it for granted. There is a rather wonderful quote, though, that he wrote for a journal once that was never printed. "I believe in musicians who are total constituents of the moment, irreplaceable, who may sing, shout, whistle, stamp their feet, in costumes always, or perhaps half naked, and I don't care which half." That's why they didn't print it for some reason. I guess those days it was a little different. Let me play just a little bit of a piece called "The Letter" with him reciting. As this was a letter he received like in 1939 from a fellow hobo friend of his. You'll notice the intonation and everything sounds quite different. Am I the right one? Yeah, there we go. Than what you've been experiencing with people like Verez.
Cincinnati, Ohio, October 2nd, 1935. Hello, pal. Gee, I was glad to hear from you. Believe it or not, pal, I just received your letter today. It must have followed me all over the world. Back on the boat.
You'll be hearing one of his last pieces called "The Dreamer That Remains," and that's also the focus of the videotape you'll see. Partch once, when asked what his influences were in his music, described them as the following: Indian chant, Japanese kabuki and no drama, Polynesian microtones, Okies in California, Balinese gamelan, Greek tragedy, dance, mime, Hollywood commercial music, Yaqui Indians, Chinese lullabies, Hebrew chants for the dead, Congo puberty rites, lumber yards, junk shops, and Boris Godunov. Boris Godunov was an opera written by Mussorgsky, a 19th century French composer. I'm not quite sure what relevance it had in his life, but he did claim it was an influence on him. Parch represents a kind of composer that I talked about from the very beginning, like Benjamin Franklin, who was a very ingenious composer. He built all of his own instruments, he devised his own music, he built it from the bottom up. The last composer we're going to talk about today was also that same sort of ilk. His name was Conlon, it still is, fortunately, Conlon Mancarrow, born the same year as Cage, 1912. Mancarrow was born in Texarkana, Arkansas. Rather well educated in music, not terribly formally in university level, but studied with several major composers. 1937, he went off to fight the fascist government in Spain. It's part of the movement there. 1939, he comes back to this country and has his passport revoked for having gone to Spain. So he moves to Mexico City and tries to figure out how to write music, essentially in seclusion. So the first thing he does is build a big percussion console, pneumatic. It didn't work very well. At the time, he was reading Henry Cowell's book, which you have excerpts from in the source book. Cowell suggested as a way of perhaps composing, the player piano might be very useful, because you could get very precise rhythmic things on the player piano. So for the rest of his life, essentially, Mancarrow has written music almost exclusively for two player pianos, which he rebuilt. He became very interested in kinds of all sorts of different things, but especially rhythmic relationships. And the piece you're going to hear is a very interesting one. It's a canon. A canon is like row, row, row your boat, where someone sings the same thing as you, but at a different, you know, starting at a different time. Well, in this case, the canon, the left hand plays the same thing as the right hand. But the left hand starts playing, it's not the left hand, it's where the left hand would be if you had a piano. The left hand starts playing at 3.5 notes a second, and by the end of the piece, speeds up to 111 notes per second. So it starts, by the end it's going so fast I won't even try to imitate that. The right hand, however, starts quite fast at 37 notes a second and gradually slows down to 2 1/3 notes a second. And he calls it the X canon because right in the middle of the piece, they're right at the same speed and they cross over. One slows down while the other one speeds up. And basically it's based, the whole piece is a kind of process piece. It's almost very serial in a certain way. It has the tune of it, or which is going to be imitated, is a 54-note tune. And then it's repeated with the first note missing. Then it's repeated with the first two notes missing. And so it's repeated 54 times until only one note is left. And that's how the piece goes. And it's repeated in a systematic way, using procedures that are very much like serial music. You've heard a little bit of Mancarrow and some of the others, and if you're interested, there, I think the Harvard Library has pretty much the complete Mancarrow, which is about right now in the upper 40s or so. And some of the later studies are very interesting because they're for two-player pianos at the same time. So that's going to be what that's going to sound like a little bit to you. This notion of rhythm. Sort of very distorted. And he went on to experiment with all sorts of kind of rhythmic things, like some very abstract numbers, like what if you apply pi to rhythm, or the square root of 2 to rhythm, etc. You could do this very precisely because it was composing on a punch card for a player piano, so you could measure distances, and so you could get very accurate proportions because there were actually measurements. The only time he returned to this country until much later was 1947, when he went to New York to have his piano punching machine, the one that punched the holes, rebuilt so he could punch a lot more holes than it was equipped to do. Well, basically, these people we've been talking about in a certain way represent a kind of misfit in American culture, people who didn't. And I want to make one quick distinction, and it's one we're going to come back to a lot, so I'll make it now. And that's the distinction between a revolution and a rebellion. I love etymology. Revolution comes from re, which means again, and volvere, which means to revolve or turn. So revolution is a like a revolution, something that recurs and returns. Rebellion comes from re, which means again, and bellare, which means to wage war. To wage a war, in a way, can never win, because if you're fighting something, you're doing everything you're doing because of the context of what you're fighting against. If you write music that's purposely not tonal, in a sense, all your decisions are controlled by tonality because you're doing everything that isn't tonal. A revolution is something much more sincere. It's a dramatic change in people. Now, what if you're a misfit, like a Nan Caro, a Parch, someone who doesn't fit in the mainstream? Well, you have two choices. Either you can consciously, as much as possible, try to change your character so that in some way you're socially more acceptable, or you can do what these gentlemen did and take the notion that it doesn't matter really if society accepts me one way or another. I'm committed to being myself because of the revolution that has happened in the culture of my time and because of the American society at this time. I don't fit in. If I don't fit in, what can I do? I can explore my identity. I can explore my own uniqueness. And this is the essence of what Feldman was saying, that the one wonderful thing about art is that it allows these people to be themselves, to really to live a life exploring their own identity. That explains, in some ways, I think, the purpose of music for the composer. But it doesn't explain the purpose of music for the listener. Duchamp had the theory that a piece of art is incomplete, that a composer or a painter or whatever doesn't really know what they're doing. It's sort of like particle physics in a way. It's not really realized until the listener hears it. And then there's a kind of magic symbiosis between the piece of art and the listener, sort of like electricity that can only happen with this polarity. And it's the work of art doesn't exist without the listener. So what's the purpose of music for the listener? Well, I think that's one of the real joys of music, and that's that we can't tell you. No one knows how you're listening to a piece of music. You live with a piece of music the way you want to live with a piece of music. You are free to hear a piece of music any way you want. That is the beauty of the whole situation. There is no right, there's no wrong, there's no real social sense, because you're not interacting with society directly, you're interacting with this kind of abstraction which certainly emerges from a cultural reality and emerges from people like these composers. Another thing Duchamp said, which I'll leave you with, is Duchamp said that after about 30 or 40 years of art, 30 or 40 years, a piece of art or a piece of music loses its aura, loses that kind of magic transmission because it's too separate from the culture. And at that stage, it's either forgotten or, as he says, enters the purgatory of art history. So just perhaps the music you're listening to now still has the ability to spark the way you listen in a way that Beethoven can't, because you're part of the very culture that created this music. And we will go on next week, switching back channels again and going back to the experimental approach and how these concepts of how to write music manifest themselves in the compositions themselves. So have a good weekend, and see you later.